This is the second session this week devoted to a study and some reactions to Phyllis Trible's book, Texts of Terror, Some Literary Feminist Readings of Biblical Narratives. Yesterday we did an introduction session on images of God's suffering, and today and the rest of the week we'll be looking at four women in the Old Testament, all of whom suffered greatly. The one today is Hagar, the Egyptian slave girl of Sarah and Abraham. To get us started this morning, I asked Ray McKeever if he would come in and sing a song with us, an appropriate song, and he was willing to do that. And so I'm going to have Ray take over at the beginning here. I guess you'll have to do some teaching, too.
Yes. We have this song in a book here at Holden Village, a book called Ever Flowing Streams, but evidently it's not in this building. I thought it was just going to be right out here. When you asked me to do the song, or I offered to do it, and then you told me what the course was about, I thought there's no way I can sing a song that is as heavy as it sounds like some of the material you're going to be dealing with. However, in some sort of parallel way, I think that the situation for many women in the world today is just as heavy, maybe not as overtly brutal. But there's some wonderful songs of hope that have come out, and so I said we could sing a song of hope. This is a song called Song of the Soul, and for those of you that know the verses, feel free to sing along, and the rest of you, I think you'll pick up the chorus pretty easily, and this will give you a head start on the concert for tonight. We'll be singing the song at the concert, so you already know it goes like this.
Love of my life, I am crying. I am not dying. I am dancing, dancing along in madness. There is no sadness, only a song of the soul, and we'll sing this song. Why don't you sing along, and we can sing for a long, long time. Why don't you sing this song? Why don't you sing along, and we can sing for a long
time. For all we know, that may be the first time in all of history that Hagar had a song sung for her. And next time I see Phyllis Trible, I'm sure I will, at another Society of Biblical Literature meeting. I see her every once in a while. I'm going to tell her that we did this today. And I think she's going to be moved at that. Why don't we take a look at the story first, briefly, so that we all are acquainted with it. It's a very brief story. In two chapters of Genesis, it's even an interrupted story. Phyllis Trible says of Hagar in this chapter that she titles The Desolation of Rejection, that Hagar is one of the first females in Scripture to experience use, abuse, and rejection. And Trible goes on to point out that what story we have about Hagar is fragmentary, so it's not complete. There's very little said about her. And, of course, it's told from the perspective, not of Hagar, but of those who used her and abused her. As Trible says, it's from the oppressor's perspective. So it's very difficult to draw a portrait of this woman. But let's look at them anyway. There are two scenes. The first scene is in Genesis chapter 16. It's the entire chapter. And if you looked at Texts of Terror, you will have noted that Trible outlines this chapter as a chapter that develops a theme in a circle. Because Hagar begins in bondage. She is a slave girl who's a maid to her mistress, Sarah. She flees this difficult situation, but she ends up going back into the bondage when the chapter is over. And so Tribble calls this a circular sort of a story. She goes very far to end up where she began. If anything, she may have ended up even worse off than where she had been at the beginning. We tend to think of circular stories as making some progress. Hagar seems to be in a circle in which perhaps she even undergoes some regress. And that's what makes the story, from Hagar's perspective at least, so terrifying. The story tells us in its introductory verse, in this scene here at least of the story, this first scene, that Abram's wife, Sarah — remember there are name changes for Abraham and Sarah in the Old Testament stories here in Genesis. So at this point they're still being called Sarai and Abram. And she was unable to bear him any children, but she had an Egyptian maid whose name was Hagar. And in this first little section, Sarai develops the idea of giving this maid to her husband so that she might get a child through her. "Behold now," she says, "the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go in to my maid. It may be that I shall obtain children by her." Notice it's as if Hagar has no personality whatsoever. She's a surrogate mother at this point. And the child, officially, I suppose, is supposed to belong to Abram and Sarai. There's some indication now that we've got — Tribble doesn't talk about this because it's not her interest — but there's some indications we have from documents now from Mesopotamia, especially in from the Palestinian area, but especially from upper Mesopotamia and the Euphrates, some of the cities there, that in the second millennium BC, so I'm talking from about 2000 to 1000, in that era, towards the beginning of that era is when we think these stories are supposed to have their setting, that one of the customs was that wives were expected to give their husbands children, specifically male children. And if they didn't do that, there are now some marriage contracts that have been discovered in which the wife was obligated, if she couldn't give her husband a son, to give the husband a substitute wife so that you could get a son. And so one way that you would do that is you would make sure that that substitute wife was under your thumb if you were, you know, well enough and had a slave girl. And then what happened is that that son — and there are other indications we now have of various legal contracts of adoption — the son would then be adopted by, you know, the father as really being his son and heir. The only problem is that then if another son were actually born to the father and his number one wife, then this first son would get aced out of it. And of course that's what happens later on in this story, those of you who know it ahead. But it appears as though officially this child was to be adopted by Abraham and Sarah, because notice how she says that. "It may be that I will get children through her." Of course, it doesn't turn out that way, does it? As Tribble so beautifully shows in her analysis, that when Sarah's plan was carried out, and Abraham rather passively goes along with it, right? This isn't very often that you hear that the men go along so willingly with their wives' suggestions, but it doesn't appear as though he had any objection at all. She just tells him to do it, and it says, and Abraham listened.
After all, wasn't he pretty old? Yeah, he was pretty young.
Yeah, well, those ages are an interesting thing in the story too, I think. So it says here that Sarah took Hagar, the Egyptian, her slave maid, and gave her to Abraham, her husband, as a wife. And he went in to Hagar — in Hebrew that's a double entendre, he went in two ways — both into her tent and into Hagar, literally, and she conceived. And this is what Sarah had not expected. When she saw that she had conceived, Sarah was belittled in her eyes. And we'll have to come back to that, because Tribble has an interesting explanation of that. And then Sarah gets upset. She doesn't like the way her plan has turned out, and she gets very angry about it, and says, may the Lord judge between you and me, to her husband. And Abram says, well, if you're really that upset, do whatever you want. This is a slave girl. She's in your power. Do to her whatever you want. And Sarah becomes very mean to her. Says Sarah deals harshly with her, so she flees. So we've gone from bondage to flight. End of episode one, this first scene. The second episode is now set out in the wilderness, on the way to Shur, way down towards Egypt, down towards her homeland. And it says a messenger from the Lord. In Hebrew, the word is malak, and it means a messenger. Our Bibles usually say angel, which is the Greek word for messenger. And so I wish we wouldn't use that word, because I suspect most people, when they hear about the word angel, they either think of some, you know, beautiful person with long white robes and wings, like you have in the Annunciation pictures, or else you think of these chubby little naked little babies flying around in the sky. And I just think that's incredibly confusing. This is a heavenly messenger, whatever the heavenly messenger looked like. It would appear as though, in several occasions in the Old Testament, the heavenly messenger just looks like another human being, comes sort of like in human disguise. Or sometimes it's just a voice. Anyway, she's found by this heavenly messenger. It's a male one. He says to her, Hagar, slave maid of Sarah, where have you come from? Where are you going? And with an interesting twist, as Tribble points out, she doesn't say where she's come from. She says who she's fled from, right? I'm fleeing from my mistress, Sarah. And if you expected the heavenly messenger at this point to say, that's right, you have really been abused, it's not fair, time for you to be delivered, well, you've got a surprise. Go back and submit. And then comes a double promise, a promise in verse 10 that she's going to have many, many descendants, and a promise in verse 11 that she's going to have a son, together with a description of what kind of son he will be. We then have a reaction by Hagar in verses 13 and 14. And the resume now of what happened, she goes back home, and sure enough, she has a son, and the name of the son is Ishmael. Right, that's the first scene. And it says that the child was born to Abram when he was 86 years old. We'll come back to some specifics. Let's look now briefly at, so do you see what Tribble means when she says this is a circular scene? She starts in bondage. She flees when her mistress's plan doesn't work out quite the way the mistress had thought the plan would work out. But then she is told to go back. And she goes back into bondage. Maybe worse off in her situation, although perhaps we could say she's got at least something now that she hadn't had before. Because what's that? She has a promise, and she has a son, and the son seems to be a down payment on a possible future, which she hadn't seen before. So even though the circle is closed, there appears to be a possibility for the circle opening into a future. But we're not really sure about that, because she's back under the thumb of her mistress, and the son officially isn't her son, not in the eyes of her mistress and her mistress's husband. You see, that's the problem. Tribble doesn't talk about chapter 17, but I wanted to say a couple of words because this underscores the fact of how this boy, as it were, is taken away from Hagar. And even though she bore him, it really isn't her son. It's that very famous chapter about the sign of circumcision. And I don't think many people remember this, that when, according to these stories anyway, there are later traditions where it appears as though circumcision was first observed in Moses' time. And there's another one in which maybe it was first observed in the wilderness and by Joshua. But there are different traditions about that. This tradition says that it was given to Abram. Most people think of Abram and Isaac at that point. But of course, Isaac wasn't born yet. And so it was Abram and his son Ishmael who received the sign of circumcision. The boy that Hagar had born as a surrogate mother for Abram and Sarai. As you read the end of this chapter 17, verse 22, it says, 23, then Abraham took Ishmael, his son, notice not a word about Hagar, Ishmael, his son, and all the slaves born in his house, so Ishmael is special, or slaves he had bought with money, every male among the men of Abraham's house, and he circumcised the flesh of their foreskins that very day, as God had said to him. Abraham was 99 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, and Ishmael his son was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. That very day, Abraham and his son Ishmael were circumcised, and all the men of his house, those born in the house and those bought with money from a foreigner, were circumcised with him. Anything significant about Ishmael's age? What's the age? 13.
Puberty.
It's the age of puberty, isn't it? And that's right. And nowadays, and for a long, long time already, Jewish people have observed the ceremony of bar mitzvah. You know what bar mitzvah means, by the way?
Son of the law.
Son of the commandment, yes. Bar is the Aramaic word for son. In Hebrew, it's ben. And mitzvah is a command. So if you're a son of the commandment, it means now you're obligated to observe the Torah. You're obligated to observe as a Jew the requirements of the God. Before that, you're not required because you're only a child. Now, isn't that striking? See, that it should be at the age of 13, and it's precisely at that age that Ishmael, in effect, you see, Ishmael is the first bar mitzvah boy in the Old Testament. And this is what's going to add the real crunch when we get to the second scene that involves Hagar. This is very striking. He's bar mitzvah. He's made a son of the covenant according to this tradition in chapter 17. And in this chapter, not a word about Hagar. It's Abraham's son. All from the male perspective, and she has nothing to do with it here. Okay, now let's look at the second scene now. That in between here now, you know, comes the story of the birth of Isaac. So when we come to chapter 21, which is the second scene that involves Hagar, some time has already passed, and Isaac has been born. Lots of time has passed, right? We're 13 years and more since the first scene. What's happened to Hagar during all this time? Not a word about her. She's just a slave, after all. Her story is not important. The second chapter, Phyllis Tribble analyzes as being a linear chapter. if the first scene was a circular scene, going from bondage to flight and back to bondage, this second scene or chapter in her story, she sees as a line. It's a line that's going from bondage through expulsion, she doesn't flee this time, she's expelled, to exile. Because when her story ends, she's out in the middle of nowhere, as it were. So let's look at this one briefly. And it doesn't start until about verse 9 of chapter 21. First part is in verses 9 through 14. Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian. Notice how neat these perspectives change, you see. Now things have changed. Isaac is on the scene. And instead of calling this the bar mitzvah son of Sarah and Abraham, Ishmael, it becomes this anonymous, the son of Hagar the Egyptian. That's striking how the narrator kind of puts us into the mindset of whoever happens to be looking at the situation. All depends on where you are in the social structure and how you see this. She sees the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, playing with her son Isaac. And she said to Abraham, throw out this slave woman and her son. Remind you of things that we do at home when we get angry at our children, you know? Sweetheart, will you please tell your children to be quiet? Right? It's your daughter, not mine. I'm in charge of the boys in the family. You take care of the girls, whatever. Well, cast out this slave woman and her son. The son of this slave woman is not going to have any inheritance with my son, Isaac. Now you see, even if they had worked this out contractually, and the story never tells us about any contracts. See, that's the interesting part. We have some fill-in now as what we know happened generally in the Middle East at that time, but we have no idea whether they actually did this. Because they're sort of shown as being on the fringes of the general cultures of the times. We don't know whether they had written contracts or not between them. Nevertheless, even though the contracts were unwritten, even if Isaac now were somehow becoming number one son, it still wasn't the case that the other son would have been completely elbowed out and gotten zero. She doesn't want him to have a thing. Nothing. Response here.
Are these two stories by the same writer? Is that talking about some of the difference of...
Yeah, you mean like, are we doing a J writer here or a P writer?
Yeah.
17, the circumcision story doesn't seem to fit in. That seems to be from another writer. But people like Tribble and others have been arguing recently that a lot of our recent emphasis on various strands in Genesis, right, different writers and so forth, helpful though that may be, still doesn't deal with the final problem, which is that now the story has been put together as one, and this is the way it's come down in the tradition. And those who put it together this way in the tradition were making sense of it the way it is now, and so we need to make sense of it the way it is now too. You certainly have a lot of affinities between the one in 16 and the one here, as over against the episodes in between. At any rate, notice Abram's response this time. Do you remember the first time when Sarah said, go into my maidservant Hagar, and Abraham did it. This time we have a different response. He refuses. He says, this thing was very displeasing to Abraham on account of his son. Look at the warring perspectives. Even though Sarah at the beginning had said, I will get a son through her. But once the son was born, it was very different. She could never forget that physically it was Hagar's son. And so even though Abraham is still accepting the boy as his son. He's been bar mitzvahed after all, even. They didn't use the word bar mitzvah back then, I'm sure, but that's in effect what happened. See, Sarah has never made her peace with this. But Abraham is displeased on account of his son, and now he gets a divine message. But God says to Abraham, don't be displeased because of the lad, no name again, and because of this slave woman, no name again. Whatever Sarah, she's the named one, says to you, do as she tells you, for through Isaac, he's the named one, shall your descendants be named. And I will make a nation of the son of the slave woman too, because he is your offspring. Almost as if that's an afterthought. So he rose early in the morning, that means shift of episode, and he took bread and a skin of water, we read this last night at Vespers, and gave it to Hagar, putting it on her shoulder, along with the child, and sent her off. This is what she got after all those years. In a household filled with slaves, both born there and bought into the household, a man who's rich in flocks and herds and who knows what all else. And this is what she gets and what her son gets. A day's ration of pita bread and a skin of water. And go take a hike, folks. And we really don't want to see you back. Once you get to Holden Lake, just keep going. The thing that gets me is that I had never read this story from that perspective before I had Tribble's book. I've always read this story from the point of view of Abram and Sarah. I never read this story from the point of view of Hagar. Never. I don't ever recall that I had sympathies for her. I mean, as you look back in your own reading of Easter, do you recall that you ever felt sorry for Hagar before? That this isn't fair. Well, I have never read it that way. I've always, because the writer, of course, brings you, he puts you into the viewpoint mainly of Sarah, and Abraham, in fact, even God takes that side finally. Well, you're not the only one who has trouble believing that. You know, Muslims don't believe this at all. We'll talk about that later. They have a completely different tradition that's developed. Okay, so much for that first episode in the second scene. The second episode has them back in the wilderness. You see how these scenes also mirror each other. In the first scene, it was the same thing. Something happens at home, something happens in the wilderness. Now here, the same thing in chapter 21. Something happens at home, something happens in the wilderness. Each time what happens at home has to do with this business about a child, right? And the two women looking for the favor of their husband, and which son, right? Each time when you're in the wilderness, as we'll see, the God visits, either himself or through a messenger, Hagar. So, second episode in this second scene. So she left. And she wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And interesting, Tribble points out that the word here for wander in Hebrew, talah, really means to sort of wander aimlessly. Really, sort of like get lost. See, in the first one, she sort of knew where she was going. It looked, she fled, she took the initiative, and it looked like she was on her way towards home, towards Egypt. See, it gives you the sense of purposiveness on her part. Here, even by using this verb in Hebrew, wander around aimlessly, it's at a completely different mood. She was kicked out unprepared. She hadn't thought of it. She hadn't made any plans. She's got a little bread and a little water, and she's out in the middle of nowhere. Probably doesn't know her way.
The boy was over 14.
Now, the boy is 14. But it's interesting because when you read the story, you wouldn't guess that he was that old yet, see? And that's why the gentleman's question before about the possibility of different sources
makes some sense. It seems very strange if the lad is already 13, 14, 15, or whatever here. Because doesn't it sound as though in verse 14 she's also carrying the lad? So you can read that in two ways. It says, put the bread and the water on her shoulder, like a backpack. And it says, along with the child. Does that mean along with the child on her shoulder, or with the child along with her? See?
Is there a clue?
Not real clear. No, I don't think it's real clear. But look at 15. I mean, you don't do this with a 14-year-old boy, do you? Throw him under the bushes? I could see him throwing her under the bushes. You know, especially if he's the kind of lad that supposedly he is. They say he's growing up to be this stout hunter, and then, or is he going to not shoot up until he's 25 and all of a sudden? You see? We're a little bit late bloomer. So, well, maybe. Anyway, when the water in the skin was gone, she put the child under one of the bushes, and she went and sat down a good way off, the distance of a good long bow shot, because she said, I don't want to see this lad die. That hardly seems like a mother with a teenager. It sounds very much like a young child. So it may well be that these stories have been displaced for whatever emphasis now the writers want to have. Maybe originally that was a, you know, a single story and took place when Isaac, well, took place sooner. Who knows? At any rate, she doesn't want to see the death of the child. And as she sat some distance from him, the Hebrew text says, she lifted up her voice and wept. The old Greek translation says, he lifted up his voice and wept. And therefore, depending on what translation you've got in English, you will find one of them in the text and usually a footnote to the other. The RSV that we have has chosen to go along with the Greek text. It says, the child lifted up his voice, and there's a note, and when you go down it says, that's Greek. But the Hebrew reads, she lifted up her voice. Do you see it in the footnote? First it says GK, means we're reading Greek here. Then it's got a colon, and it says, but the Hebrew is, she lifted up her voice. Of course, both the Hebrew and the Greek text were authoritative for the rabbis around the time of Jesus. And then some years after Jesus, the rabbis chose one particular kind of Hebrew text, which was somewhat different from the Greek translation, which the church retained. And then they began to argue over which was the real Bible. That's another old story that we're acquainted with, too. So I'll go along with the Hebrew. And we'll make this Hagar weeping. And the Tribble very nicely calls this, especially if you think of the child as being young, but even if the child is already a teenager, it's a sort of a Pieta-like scene. She says, here you have the Madonna and child abandoned, and the mother weeping for the child. And if Hagar hadn't been undercut enough all through this story, when it's her son, it isn't her son, and it's not recognized as her son. Look at what it says in verse 17. And God heard the voice of the lad. Now that's why some people want to make it the lad crying in the verse before. And now you can see why Tribble prefers to stick with the Hebrew, that it was Hagar crying in the verse before, because Tribble says, at this point, God doesn't even pay attention to her. Nobody pays attention to Hagar. They're all worried about the son. Even God is worried about the boy. She's crying. He pays attention to whatever whimpering the boy is doing. God heard the voice of the lad, and the messenger from God then called out to Hagar from heaven. So he must have heard her too anyway. And says, what is troubling you, Hagar? Don't be afraid. God has heard the voice of the lad where he is. So get up, lift up the lad, and hold him fast with your hand. I will make him a great nation. Notice what's happening. she again recedes into being the secondary person. Now what she's good for, having been a slave to first to Sarah and then to Abraham, now what is she good for?
Bring the boy up.
Yeah, as it were, to become a slave to child rearing for her son. That verse reminds me of at least two women that I remember from my childhood. Two very lovely women. They were wonderful ladies. And they did a lot of nice things for me. But the picture that I have of them is really being enslaved to their children. And their children were grown-up children in their 20s. And I just remember these women having practically no time to themselves, doing practically nothing for themselves, doing everything for their husband and children, older children, grown-up children. And my view of them, even as a child, I didn't think that was fair. It seemed to me that they were like slaves in their own house. All I ever remember them doing is cooking and putting out meals and then cleaning and then getting ready for the next one to come home from work. And it was a hard life. And I don't say this to put them down, because to me they were gorgeous women. They were older women to me, and I love them both very much. They used to do little favors for me, like bring me radishes from the garden.
But did they feel that way?
I don't know whether they did, you know?
Probably they
did. It appears to me they certainly had made peace with that way of living. I do remember that they looked awfully tired most of the time. That I remember. At any rate, here's Hagar, and the God now tells her, now take care of the son. Used to take care of Sarah, used to take care of Abraham, now take care of this boy. Lift him up, hold him fast with your hand, I'll make him a great nation. Then God opens her eyes, she sees a well of water, she goes, fills the skin with water, and gives the boy a drink. First appropriate act. Serves him, gives him the water. And the last you hear, all right. God was with the lad, not with her. And he grew up. She didn't develop. He lived in the wilderness. He became an expert with the bow. He lived in the wilderness of Paran. Later, his mother got a wife for him from the land of Egypt. Once again, doing something on behalf of the son. And that's the end of her story. There's one place where she's mentioned later in a genealogical list. That's it.
Paul mentions her also.
Yes, in the New Testament. And we'll talk about that too. Well, those are the way the scenes develop. So Tribble talks about a circular scene in the first one, from bondage to flight that she chooses back to bondage. And in the second one, a linear development from bondage to expulsion, a flight she didn't choose, and exile in the wilderness. What about, we've talked about a few of the themes in here, and I'd like to touch on, come back to some of them and highlight them or underscore them. We talked about one motif in the first scene, back in 16, this wonderful reversal. There are a lot of these reversals that go on in the stories. The reversal between Sarah's expectation and what actually happened, right? Sarah was seeking building up, but the Hebrew says she becomes slighted in the eyes of Hagar. Some of our translations say Hagar despised her. That's a possible translation, but it may be putting it a little bit too strongly. What it means is that, you see, now Hagar finally had something that her mistress didn't have. And what it did is, it sort of cut Sarah back down to size. It's not so much that she's being despised as being brought back down to size. Instead of being built up, she was slighted. And in a sense, you see, there's a reversal of the roles there. This is a marvelous thing because when my wife and I were in a group home, we had a group home for girls. Oh, this is already 10 years ago that we had this. And we had teenage girls in that home that we were caring for the social services of Winnebago County, Wisconsin. And I remember one of our girls in the group was not there because she was in trouble. It was because her parents were quite incompetent and really couldn't take care of her. And she was also very slightly retarded and somewhat overweight, and she had a very poor self-image. And the other girls sort of took advantage of her, just about everybody took advantage of her. Well, you know what she finally did to raise herself up? You can guess. That's right. By a college boy, no less. She didn't keep the child, but she had the child. And it was amazing to see how, especially towards the last couple of months of her pregnancy, the respect she started to get from the other girls in the house, because she was in on something they didn't know about. And she had finally accomplished something that they hadn't accomplished. And I must say, it gave my wife and me a whole different slant on why teenagers do or do or don't allow themselves to get pregnant, at least some of them. Because in her case, I think even if she had known, and I think the social workers had told the girls all about contraceptives, I think she probably decided not to. It had the effect of raising her up, if only temporarily, and bringing the rest of them down to size, as it were. They had all their A's and B's against her C's, D's, and F's, true. But she had a baby. Well, that's this reversal in scene one that, of course, gets Sarah then very upset. Another thing that Tribble underscores in here, which I had never seen before, again, another thing I had missed in all the years. I mean, I should see these things. I've been studying this for over 20 years now. I mean, I teach it every year, so you expect you're supposed to see things, but you see, there's always something new to be found. And Tribble has shown, I think, very convincingly, how the story of Hagar is a pre-mirroring or a foreshadowing of the story of the Exodus, and yet in her case, it's all opposites. Everything ends up going the wrong way for her, as it were. She flees the way the Israelites flee from oppression in Egypt. But when they flee, they're going away towards liberty. When she flees, the circle comes back and she goes home. There's even a parallel between the encounter. Moses had fled, remember, earlier, before the Exodus. And when he had fled, he was given a new life. He found this woman right at the well and got a wife and then went back. Well, Hagar also goes to meets God in the wilderness, but she's sent back home. And there are other parallels to this, too. Finally, in scene two, where it's said that she gets driven out. It's the same verb that's used in the Exodus story when the Pharaoh drives out the Hebrews. Of course, they wanted to be driven out. At this point, she no longer wanted to be driven out. She wanted her place in the household in scene number two after she's had the son. Everything seems to work upside down for her. When she departs, Tribble says, on page 23 to 21, verse 14, where it says she departs. Tribble says, departing her land of bondage, Hagar knows not Exodus, but exile, when she departs. And when she wanders aimlessly in the wilderness, she has no cloudy pillar by day or fiery pillar by night to guide her. She's really lost out there. In fact, I think Tribble could have pushed us even further. You know, there's miraculous feeding and all the rest in the wilderness for the Israelites. Well, she does get at least a little bit of that. There's at least enough there to keep her and her son alive. They don't die. But they don't really get to a promised land, at least not in these episodes. So there's some very interesting things going on here. And one wonders now, again, you see, if Hagar has simply, if she's simply being used now, since she's the Egyptian, you see, she's an Egyptian. So you mirror it. All the things go wrong for her, and when it's Israel leading Egypt, all the things go right for them. Is she sort of being punished early on behalf of the Egyptians who are going to come later? See, is this, does she simply become a cipher in the text now to sort of get the readers ready for what will happen later on? In which case, again, the real personality of this woman, if there ever was a real personality, is just submerged one more level. Yes, please.
It's significant also that Abraham Lincoln came in, that she actually goes back off the
cliff. Oh, sure. Everything's opposite. That's right. And she would like to have gone to Egypt, but she doesn't get there. She ends up in the wilderness.
Bill, are there Coptic texts or other kinds of tellings of the story besides of Muslim that would have a different
Jewish? Christian tellings?
Yeah.
If there are, I'm not acquainted with them. I have to admit, I've never been interested in Hagar's story. I admit. I never read her part of the story with any interest. The only part of the story that ever interested me was the Ishmael-Isaac. Rivalry. I can't say I've ever really cared for Hagar. And I think I was tipped off, and I would suspect that most Old Testament readers were tipped off to feel negative because she's identified right at the beginning as being an Egyptian. Well, anybody who knows the national story knows what the Egyptians are going to do later. And so you don't really feel that sorry for her. But she's an Egyptian. She's a slave.
Manipulation of the news.
Is that it? Manipulation of the news.
Mm-hmm. You don't always get the whole story.
Yeah. Well, a couple of other things that we need to point out since we're running low on time. I think we're down to, what, 3-4 minutes only?
No, we've got about 10 maybe.
Do we? Since we started a little late. Well, did you notice how often in these stories you have these key words, especially for seeing, how often that comes up? And this phrase, it doesn't always show in the English, unfortunately, but Tribble has shown it in her translation. She translates very literally all the time, and how often the phrase in the eyes of comes up. So you have in the eyes of and seeing. It's very striking. Follow with me, for example. In the very first section, it tells you in 16:4-5, when Hagar saw that she had conceived, her mistress was belittled in her eyes, was slightened in her eyes. She came down to size. As an immediate response to that, when Sarah gets upset, Abraham says, do to her whatever is good in your eyes, it says in the Hebrew. Your RSV says, as you please. I wish the translators had been more stodgy here. See, sometimes there's an advantage to a translation that isn't flowing, and that's more stodgy, because then you can see how the Hebrew writers have been using plays on these words. So she's seeing things one way, Sarah's going to see things another way, and of course the climax of that scene is this incredible seeing in the wilderness, right? When she's in the wilderness and the messenger calls to her from the Lord and gives her this double promise, which you think is going to be great for Hagar, but as it turns out, is going to be somewhat great for her son, but kind of leave her on the edges anyway. But she says in verse 13, she called the name of the Lord who spoke to her, you are a God of seeing And in Hebrew, it's not clear if it means the God has seen her in her affliction, or she has seen the God through the messenger. In fact, probably both is intended, are intended. It's a double way of seeing. But see how nice that picks up this other motif of she seeing something and Sarah doing as seems right in her eyes, and the God seeing. And she then says, have I really seen God and remained alive after seeing him? Again, it's a very unusual question, and we're not really sure what she's saying here, because we have some question about how she's going to be remaining alive, what kind of life is it she's having. And she calls the name of this place the well of a living seeing one. Does that mean the God who's living and sees? Does it mean her having had this marvelous vision that she's still alive? Because this is always considered miraculous when you have a vision of the divine and it doesn't just wipe you out. And Tribble says there's something very special, at least, that ought to be underscored here, and that is that she's the first woman, in fact, she's the first person in the Bible who gives the God a direct name. She gives a name to the God here. No one has ever named God that way before. It's rather daring. She's also the first woman, in fact, I think the only, who ever gets a promise like verse 10. The promises are always given to the men about multiplied descendants. It's usually to Abraham, then to Isaac, then to Jacob. And so there are some ways in which the text sort of lifts her up to kind of beat her back down. And this is why Tribble feels a sense of terror in the text. She says, every time you think that she's, you know, there's liberation coming for her, something really special happens to her, she kind of gets pushed back down. She's also the first woman to have an annunciation scene in verse 11. Same kind of a scene that will come later to Sarah. The same sort of scene later that will come to the mother of Samson, that will come to Hannah, Samuel's mother, that will come to Elizabeth and to Mary in the New Testament. Hagar is the first one to get it. Behold, you are pregnant and you're going to have a son, and you ought to call his name such and such because he will be this way. You recognize that formula. She's the first one. And every time you have a sense, you know, there's an opening for her into the future, but she gets crushed. Or at least the opening is only through her son, and she's going to have to bask in his limelight. Well, that seeing motif is picked up very powerfully again in the second scene. Right at the beginning, you start that second scene with Sarah doing some seeing. She sees that boy playing with her boy, and she doesn't like it, right? And when she tells it to Abraham, it says, it's distressing in his eyes. And God says, oh, don't let that be so distressing in your eyes. And then when they're out in the wilderness, what does Hagar see? She says, I don't want to see the death of my son. And finally, in verse 19, God opens her eyes, and she sees the well of water. It's striking how this seeing imagery, and one gets the sense of, you know, did she see more out of her oppression that the rest of us who either aren't oppressed or who cooperate with oppression can't see, because we're always seeing it from a different perspective? There are different ways of seeing in this story. And how has Hagar's story been told even further down the line? Well, there's that ironic twist in Paul's letter to the Galatians, where he compares Hagar and her son to the old covenant under Sinai. How strange, since this is long before Sinai, and Hagar and her son were kicked out. The one place, I think, where Hagar has sort of gotten a better press is in Islam. Because, of course, the Arabs are descended from Ishmael, and in their minds, God never went back on that promise and on that covenant that was recorded. And that's part of the, you know, the argument from a religious standpoint between Muslims and Jews, because the Arabs, by bloodline, trace themselves to Abraham through Ishmael and Hagar. The Jews, by bloodline, trace themselves to Abraham through Sarah. By bloodlines, Jews and Arabs are united. Of course, as you know, Islam is much larger than Arabs. A lot more Muslims besides just Arabs. But at least in Islam, there are stories about Hagar, and you can actually, if you're a Muslim, visit the well of water that God made to spring up for her. When you go on pilgrimage, it's right there at Mecca. That's the spot where it had come up. And part of your pilgrimage is you remember Hagar by running back and forth between the bush and the well of water. You repeat the frenzied search of Hagar for water. At least the Muslims remember her.